Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In July 1894, Shibli published Safarname-i Rum o Misr o Sham, Turkey, Egypt, and Syria, a travelogue. Writing mostly in the early months of 1894, Shibli paints a vivid, critical, and sometimes humorous picture of the social, political, and intellectual life of the Ottoman Empire and Egypt in the 19th century. Shibli's account is remarkable in that it draws not only on his personal recollections and experiences, but also on the kind of archive that appealed to him as a historian inspired by the Enlightenment and by the classical Arabic tradition. Government and institutional records, which he collected on his travels, and classical and contemporary Turkish and Arabic literature. The narrative records firsthand accounts and secondary source information about educational institutions, including colleges, printing houses, manuscript archives, libraries, literary societies, and debate clubs, complete with charts detailing student enrollment, school curricula, and library catalogs, to which Shibli often adds historical context through broad discussions of regional history and contemporary politics. Against the backdrop of educational institutions, Shibli records sketches and anecdotes that offer rare glimpses of intellectual networks, religious festivals, visual and literary culture, and everyday life in the Ottoman Empire and Egypt. The community of Damaskene Sufis in Istanbul, with ties to Ottoman statesmen and Sufis in India, literary intellectual salons in Beirut, Jerusalem, and Izmir, manuscript archives in Istanbul and Cairo, the Jesuit College in Beirut, descriptions of restaurants, hotels, mosques, colleges, and lodges in Istanbul, the office of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Hindu merchants in Aden, the community of Indian merchants in Istanbul, museums, theaters, and stage dramas in Cairo, the Muharram mourning rituals in Istanbul, and a brothel in Beirut. Most of the accounts favor description over analysis or reflection, but several anecdotes are specifically crafted for the purposes of edification and reform. These anecdotes reflect something of the cosmopolitanism of the Ottoman Empire and Egypt in the late 19th century. They also reflect, and sometimes directly address, the effects of colonialism on local economies and politics, and shed important light on the formative role that new forms of print media, literature, and education played in shaping the intellectual culture of the day, giving us microcosmic glimpses of broader processes of historical change. End quote. This was the translator's afterword in a translation of an Urdu language travelogue by the 19th century Muslim scholar Shibli Nomani. Our translator and our guest for today's show is Dr. Gregory Maxwell Bruce, and he is the first to translate Shibli's Safarname-i Rum o Misr o Sham, entitled Turkey, Egypt, and Syria, a travelogue in English, and published by Syracuse University Press in 2020. Gregory Maxwell Bruce holds a PhD in Asian cultures and languages from the University of Texas at Austin. He is currently a lecturer in Urdu at the University of California, Berkeley, where he teaches courses on Urdu and Persian language and literature. He is also a co-founder and co-editor of the Journal of Urdu Studies, published by Brill. His writings about Islam, South Asian intellectual history, and Hindi, Urdu, and Persian literature can be found in the South Asia Multidisciplinary Academic Journal, or SAMAJ. Sagar, as well as the Encyclopedia of Islam and Encyclopedia Iranica. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Asad, co-host of the New Books in Middle East Studies podcast, and your host for our conversation today. Today, we're speaking to Dr. Bruce about his translation of Shibli Nomani's travelogue and the significance of this particular travelogue to a wide array of thematic and disciplinary subjects. Without further ado, allow me to welcome Dr. Gregory Maxwell Bruce to our program. Welcome, Dr. Bruce.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much for joining our show today. And as always, we'd like to begin with an introduction to the life of our guest. So before we take our journey across South Asia and the Middle East with Shibli, we'd love to hear a little bit about your own journey and what brought you to writing this magisterial translation of yours.
Thank you very much for that very kind and generous introduction. Well, I was introduced to Shibli when I was in graduate school at the University of Texas at Austin. And I was fortunate to be trained by philologists and intellectual historians, and of course in Urdu and Persian literature. And I found myself in graduate seminars encountering and eventually writing about Shibli Nomani. And this eventually led me to decide to write my dissertation about him. And in the course of writing my dissertation, I came across this text. Of course, I had read at that point most of his major works. But I encountered this travelogue and began sort of reading it and thinking about its significance in his intellectual life. It was at that point that I started asking the questions that, my mentors would ask, and all intellectual historians ask, I think, things like, who are these people that he is meeting? What is this college that he's visiting? What are these books that he is picking up at libraries? And that led me to spend time in libraries, looking through biographical dictionaries, institutional records, to try to get a sense of this world that he had encountered. And the more I dug into the archives, the more convinced I became of the importance of this work, of this travelogue, the sort of uniqueness of the world that he had uncovered. It's a world that has been studied to some extent, but certainly not one that has been studied in the way that he sort of encountered it. And so I thought, having taken many, many hours of time to find out who these people were that he was encountering. Some of them, by the way, took me more than a year or two of occasional digging through archives to find information about them. I eventually decided that this would make a really good translation project, and so that turned into an ongoing process of coming to terms with meaning making in the text and all of the allusions and all of that. And eventually I finished it, and here it is.
I want to move now toward a brief biography of our protagonist and a survey of the terrain in which he lived, to which he spoke to a little bit. So for our listeners, would you be able to offer a quick sort of biographical sketch of Shibli, maybe a summary of his political and intellectual milieu and how he in particular was situated within it?
Sure. So Shibli was born in 1857. Which South Asianists know is a watershed year in the history of the subcontinent. This is the year that marks the transition from colonialism to imperialism. He's born in a, that is British colonialism to British imperialism. He's born in a small village just outside a small town, the town being Azamgarh, in what is now UP, Uttar Pradesh in modern India, the United Provinces in late British India, at the time, the Northwest Provinces. He receives an education in Arabic rationalism and also in Persian. His father knew Persian and was kind of an entrepreneur and businessman locally. And Shibli spent most of his youth studying with experts in the Arabic rational sciences. So he studied grammar and logic, he studied jurisprudential texts, he studied poetry sort of other forms of literature. And finishes his course and attempts to establish himself as a teacher, but also does what so many do who have recently finished their education, and he decided to become a lawyer. And so he eventually passes the exam to become a legal representative, but soon thereafter gets a job doing what he clearly preferred to do, which was to study and teach Arabic and Persian. And so he is hired in 1881, 1882 as a professor of Arabic and Persian at the Mohammedan Anglo-Oriental College in Aligarh. Now, what's significant about this for his life and for the travelogue, is that it was at this moment that he came into close personal contact with Sayyid Ahmad Khan, who is arguably the most influential social reformer, Muslim social reformer especially, of 19th century India. And he also came into contact with Sayyid Ahmad Khan's library. And that meant having access to books that were published in the Middle East and sent to India, purchased and distributed in India and purchased by Sayyid Ahmad Khan. And it also meant access to Urdu translations of writers like Edward Gibbon and other Enlightenment era thinkers, because of course Shibli didn't know English or any European languages. And so he starts his career teaching Arabic and Persian, reading these texts. And what his job asked him to do was to train students in the curriculum of Arabic and Persian that was prescribed by the colonial university examining boards. And so he would sort of teach Arabic and Persian language and literature in the day. And at night, I mean, so to speak, he began writing histories. And so by the time he had written the travelogue, by the time he wrote the travelogue, he had written a biography of Mamun, the Abbasid Caliph, He had just finished his second major work, which was a biography of Abu Hanifa, the eponym of the Hanafi school of Islamic jurisprudence. And he would go on in his life after writing the travelogue to write biographies of Umar ibn Khattab, al-Farouq. He would write a biography of Ghazali, of Rumi. He wrote works in theology. He wrote a magisterial four-volume study of Persian poetry. And eventually, his last major work before he passed away in 1914 was a biography of the Prophet. And, you know, many of these works remain standard texts in on their topic in Urdu today. You can still buy Shibli's travel log at any Urdu bookshop. You can still buy his biography of Ghazali. You can still purchase Sher al-Ajam, his history and critical study of Persian poetry. And so he was among the most influential writers of his time and remains among the most influential Urdu writers of ours.
Now, we know that Shibli was prolific, as you so eloquently articulated. He produced all of the scholarly work. He had a command of Arabic, Persian, and Urdu. He knew the Islamic tradition well. And it was also a time of great intellectual exchange and reform for Shibli himself, particularly in the Islamicate world. And so I'm curious now as to how Shibli's erudition and his meticulous scholarship connected to the work that he did in terms of the travelogue. What were some of the major concerns that animated Shibli that led him to undertake this journey to write the travelogue, to explore the Ottoman Middle East and to write about everything from the presence of apricots to the particularities of customs and behaviors to the educational institutions that he encountered. How was all of that sort of connected to his scholarly output, and what animated him to even begin to undertake that endeavor?
Thank you for that question. Shibli wrote as someone who stood really at the intersection of a number of projects, institutional projects, as well as scholarly reformative projects, social projects. And the travelogue reflects many of them. So on the one hand, you will note that, much of the travelogue is like charts with detailed data about, the number of students in a college in Beirut and what their what community they belong to, or the number of books that have been published by a particular press. Just sort of like this painstaking detail. And my sense is that that project of the travelogue is largely motivated by the task that he was charged with by Syed Ahmad Khan, by his sort of mentor and boss, which was to bring books back to the college and also to collect information about educational institutions, printing presses, etc. In one of the letters, I believe, in the appendix to the travelogue, he talks about sort of Persian language newspapers in Istanbul, in the Ottoman Empire, that could be used to promote their college and its sort of social reform agenda. And so on the one hand, he's sort of traveling as a fact finder for this, educational institution. But he's also traveling as a research scholar. And I mentioned earlier his biography of Mamun and his biography of Abu Hanifa, which are grounded in close study of the kinds of classical Arabic texts that were becoming increasingly available to him through print and the collection of critical editions of this literature. And he, when he traveled, he had in mind to write this book on Umar Farooq, we're told, on the second caliph of Islam from his perspective. And so he was very concerned to find books that he couldn't find in India, books that he didn't have access to in Aligarh, to copy manuscripts if he could. There are references in letters to his father, I believe, that he attempted to memorize some of these texts, at least parts of them. And so he's someone who is a research scholar, and that is another layer of the travelogue that's really fascinating to trace. I mean, his descriptions of these tiny manuscript archives in Istanbul that don't exist anymore are some of the most fascinating sort of passages in the book. He also, by the way, was, we learned from his letters to Sayyid Ahmad Khan, he was also gathering, attempting to gather texts by Al-Ghazali. Sayyid Ahmad Khan was writing about Al-Ghazali at the time and would eventually go on to publish a series of essays about him. And Shibli eventually sort of took that project and made it his own after Sayyid Ahmad Khan died and wrote his biography of Al-Ghazali as well. And so he's someone who is a research scholar. He's really interested in what's available in the libraries, what are the manuscripts that I can find, and how do these relate to my broader project of the history of Islam, the history of Muslim statesmen, Muslim philosophers, Muslim sort of jurisprudence. And that's another layer. You know, but he's also someone who is part of this milieu that sees social transformation as a means of, a whole range of objectives, obtaining a bunch of objectives. So sort of socioeconomic improvement, sort of better living conditions. And so he also is someone who is concerned with social reform. And he writes some of the travelogue in a kind of a reformer's mode. He's very concerned about certain kinds of behavior and certain forms of propriety and impropriety and what counts as good behavior and what doesn't. And that's another important part of the travelogue. He's also traveling as someone who likes to have a good time. Shibli talks about sort of the foods that he eats all of the fun that he has, especially in Istanbul. And so that's another motivation to travel. And then, of course, there's the question of why he writes the travelogue, which is a related but nonetheless separate question. So he travels in 1892, but as you mentioned at the beginning, he doesn't write the travelogue until 1894. So he's been back for well over a year by the time he begins to compile everything. He had intended to write the travelogue early on, or at least he had the idea to do it. I don't know if he intended to do it, but he had the idea to write it. But he didn't, of course. And when he eventually began writing, he was at that time in 1894, not only someone who was an Arabic and Persian professor training students, but he had become a prominent intellectual figure. He had become someone who was becoming involved with other educational institutions. The University of Allahabad, for example, and also a Congress of Scholars that was thinking about ways to sort of come together and both reform and also unify Arabic education in India, this organization called the Nadwatul Ulama. And he was writing at a moment when the place of Arabic learning in South Asia was a question mark in people's minds. The shape and future of that project was something that was being talked about. And he brings his experiences in Egypt in particular to bear on the way that he sort of begins to imagine the future of Arabic learning in his own time and for what he imagined to be future generations of students. And so all of those are part of the project of the travelogue. And it's, I think in many ways, it's one of the things that makes it such an interesting and exciting book to read.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
As one reads it, I feel like, or at least when I read it, you know, I got the sense that Shibley saw it almost as his duty to correct a lot of the misunderstandings that he felt were pervasive, be it about Arabs or Turks, Muslims, you know, Middle Easterners, quote unquote, right? He speaks in very sort of broad civilizational terms, and I suppose that is to be expected given the milieu and context of his time. But I also get the sense that, you know, he was almost advancing or attempting to advance a kind of Muslim or Islamic cosmopolitanism. And I was curious to know if this would be an accurate framing, if this is something that we can excavate from the text, this idea of this pan-Islamic community, cosmopolitan pan-Islamic community, and whether that's something that Shibley himself was articulating.
Well, thank you for that question. It's a difficult one to answer. So, I mean, on the one hand, you know, there are these passages in the travelogue in which Shibley expresses very clearly a kind of a sense of belonging that's motivated by religious community, right? I mean, you know, there's a kind of an episode when he's on the ship and he attempts to sort of show this group of Arabic speaking men from Syria that he's a scholar, and they sort of ignore him, and it's because of the way that he's dressed that they're ignoring him. It's his hat, if memory serves, but when there's a recognition that he's a Muslim and that his dress has deceived them into believing that he's not, then there's a kind of brotherhood and a deep sort of friendship that forms. And it's largely through networks of Muslim thinkers, right, that he is sort of living and experiencing Istanbul and later Beirut and Jerusalem and Cairo. And so there is a kind of, you know, sense of community and belonging, I think, that the travelogue attempts to, you know, not only to kind of represent, but also does a very good job of kind of showing the ways in which this sense of belonging is something that you know, reaches across region, and it stretches across you know, empire, and it stretches across language to an extent, right? But I say to an extent because, on the other hand, you know, Shibley is also someone who is writing acutely aware of his own sort of what we might call positionality, right? As an Indian. You know, it's largely language that becomes the vehicle for the connections that he makes. And he talks in his letters, and to an extent he talks in the travelogue itself, about not really being able to get to know very many Turks, because he doesn't speak the language, and instead spends most of his time among these sort of mostly Syrian immigrants to Istanbul, people who are there. Some are just visiting, some seem to have created a life for themselves there, students and people connected with the Ottoman state. And so there's that limitation on cosmopolitanism as a framework. And then, of course, there's another big problem with thinking about this as Muslim cosmopolitanism, at least in sort of in totalizing terms, which is that while there is this sort of sense of, you know, the flow of ideas across region, the movement of people, a sense of belonging, you know, Shibley is also someone who writes this travelogue deeply concerned with India, with South Asia, with India, with Muslims in British India and the princely states. That is his audience. And he, of course, I think one of the things then that the travelogue opens up is that, in fact, this sort of idea of cosmopolitanism is really something that maybe, if it is cosmopolitanism, we need a way to think about cosmopolitanism that relates these trans-imperial networks, this kind of sense of belonging beyond one's sort of cultural milieu, through language, through religious community, linguistic community, religious community, that all of that is mediated at the same time by a very kind of localized, grounded reality. I think that's one of the interesting aspects of the travelogue, that there's a kind of, there's a negotiation between what you've called Islamic cosmopolitanism and a very sort of Indo-Muslim cultural, intellectual, historical milieu in which Shibley writes and with which he is primarily concerned in the book.
I think in addition to that, I found one of the most fascinating qualities for me of the travelogue was its richness, both from a thematic as well as from a disciplinary standpoint. I mean, it cuts across literature, both poetry and prose. It can be read as an anthropology or an anthropological work, a historical work. It touches upon sociology, among many other disciplines. And it also touches on themes, you know, related to representation, technology, religion, colonialism, etc., in such a way that offers what I feel was a very penetrating critique of how these concepts were understood through, you know, if I may use the Foucauldian language, a Western European matrix of knowledge and power. And I know people have written and spoken about how, you know, Shibley was almost, you know, identifying these qualities long before many of our post-colonial thinkers came to identify them in their works. I personally felt as though, you know, it almost anticipated Edward Said's Orientalism. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on that, or if it can be read in such a way, or if it's, you know, how would you approach that question?
Wow, thank you. So I think that there are definite similarities between especially the introduction of the travelogue and the critique of the relationship between discourse and especially literary discourse or discourse in literature and power that resemble Said quite strikingly. So Shibli has this sort of argument that he makes about the representation of Turks and Arabs. And basically what he says is that to read European literature and not to have a kind of negative attitude about or negative stereotypes about Turks, and I'm paraphrasing here, would be like taking a soporific drug. Yeah, he used the word khab avar, yeah, a dream bringing, right, sleep inducing drug, not falling asleep. That is, that literary representation has this kind of, power to overtake the consciousness of a person. I mean, quite literally, that's sort of the metaphor, quite literally a metaphorical, that's sort of the argument, the metaphorical argument that he's making, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of similarity, I think. At the same time, Shibli's also someone who's writing in a kind of post-Enlightenment world. He's someone who is concerned with the histories of civilizations and the comparison of civilizations to an extent. He's someone who's deeply influenced by the kind of projects of writers like Edward Gibbon, but also Ibn Khaldun. He doesn't come at the question of the relationship between discourse and power, knowledge and power, literary representation, and sort of the other, in the way that Said does. I think that's in a sense is obvious because, of course, Said is responding to a very different set of theorists and writers in Orientalism. But it is striking that there is this awareness of this power. And I think that it's especially important because Shibli, of course, writes as all of the things that we've talked about already. He writes as a historian. He writes as a sort of someone trained in the Arabic rationalist tradition. He writes as a language teacher, a teacher of literature, as a researcher, as an institution builder. But he also writes as a colonized subject. So for him, with all of those interesting and important and influential, really is the word I should have used, sort of things motivating him, backgrounds motivating his ideas, he's also a colonized subject that has firsthand experience of the power of representation to change perception. And I think, I think of something like the colonial curriculum that he was teaching as an Arabic and Persian professor, and the English curriculum that his students would have also been studying and reading, and the kind of 19th century literature, the Romanticism, the forms of literature that they would have been reading, the kinds of things that Edward Said talks about in his book. And of course, the sort of arguments being advanced by people like Renan and other people about Islam, all of these things are coming down to bear on the mind, not only of Shibli and his sort of his circle of writers and teachers and thinkers, but on the minds of his students as well. And you'll notice in the travelogue that he talks a lot about students. He talks about sort of socializing with students. He talks about teaching back in India. He sort of teaches the Isahuji, which is a kind of a very short work, foundational work in Arabic logic when he's in Istanbul. And this is something he would have taught back in India and been taught in his youth. So I think he's also writing as someone, again, as a colonized subject, as a researcher, but also as someone who's observing the power of this kind of Orientalist discourse to shape perceptions, especially among students. So that's one of the impressions that I get from doing some close reading of this text and then also relating it to his intellectual life.
So as a treat for our listeners, I was curious to know what your favorite passage is from the travelogue, or at least one that sticks out to you, and how that particular passage speaks to Shibley's frame of mind and global context, which you just meticulously just described.
Well, thank you for this question. We've been talking about, intellectual history and power and knowledge and things. I think it's also important that Shibley wrote this text to entertain readers and to be something that they would want to spend time sort of engaging with. And so, in between very detailed charts that we've described and talked about earlier, he's also sharing some very colorful anecdotes. So I don't know that I have a favorite anecdote in the travelogue. There's a lot of them. There's this story about encountering the Ottoman Sultan, Abdulhamid II, right? He goes to the Salamlik, which is this kind of large procession on Friday for the Sultan to go and read namaz. He describes being set in a line with, various sort of, one imagines, dignitaries and high profile types. And he's sort of standing in this line, and the Sultan comes out, he emerges from the mosque, and all the dignitaries bow down to him, and Shibley's kind of so overwhelmed by this moment that he's coming into contact with Abdulhamid II that he forgets to sort of bow, right? And so you can imagine this line of people sort of, showing respect, and there Shibley kind of standing there mumbling, he tells us, mumbling some, prayers for him in one imagines to be Urdu or Arabic or something, and the Sultan just sort of walks by, and there's Shibley kind of standing there, and I think that that's an anecdote that is both humorous but also humanizing, and that's something that stands out. But I mean, there are others that I think I find really fascinating. There's an anecdote in which So he had brought copies of an Arabic book written on a topic in Hanafi jurisprudence that he had written in the 1870s. He brought copies of that probably to distribute to people as a way to network a little bit and to assert his, identity as a scholar and his sort of command of Arabic. And he befriends early in his journeys in Istanbul. He befriends a member of the family of Khalid Naqshbandi, who's a very influential Sufi in Syria, who Shibli tells us in the travelogue, rightly, had been initiated into the order in India by Mazhar Jane Jana in the 18th century. Now, Shibli doesn't identify as a Sufi, but he sort of, there's a kind of familiarity there already there's a connection here. We talked already a little bit about sort of belonging and Islam and Muslim community. We've talked a little bit about Arabic, and there's also a kind of trans-regional connection with India there. And he has this book that he's brought out. He's got it out on a table, and a visitor comes to visit his now roommate, this I think it's a son of Khalid Naqshbandi. The person recognizes the book and says, "Oh, my teacher back in Damascus sort of read this and praised this work." And, the anecdote itself on paper is not as, entertaining as the anecdote about Shibli not bowing to Abdulhamid II. But it is an anecdote that so importantly, I think, illustrates that knowledge, texts, people, and ideas continued to sort of move across the porous borders of empire, and that it sort of pushes back against the stereotype, especially about the modern period, which has that, you know, Arabic learning is something that really flowed from the West to the East. That is to say that, jurisprudential texts written by scholars in what's now the Middle East, those are the things that are being read and responded to in South Asia by Islamic thinkers, by Arabic scholars, etc. And it shows us this anecdote very interestingly that in fact the current moved in both directions, or at least that there were currents moving in both directions. Yeah. And I think that's an anecdote that I think is important because it leads to an insight, which is one of my favorite things about the travelogue, which is that Shibli's experiences in this book are mediated by his relationships, not with Turks. We've already talked about the language issue being a barrier to forming close relationships with Turkish speakers, but rather through a series of close friendships that he forms with Syrian immigrants, people who are living in Istanbul for because they're in school there, or because they're visiting statesmen, or because they have a connection to politics. And the kind of more you dig into the travelogue and you learn about the historical context in which Shibli's writing, the more you realize that this book is not just a really fascinating record of what it was like to be an Indian scholar and intellectual traveling to Istanbul in the 1890s. It's not just a record of sort of, by the way, Indian networks at Istanbul. Of course, he meets this community of Indians there and spends time, a little bit of time with them, befriends them. But it's also a record of this kind of experience of the city through the eyes of this kind of Syrian community of, let's call them immigrants, or at least people who are visiting for an extended period. Yeah. The evidence for this is all over the place, but, there's some interesting philological evidence for this, the names of things that Shibli shares with us. He's constantly giving us not only Arabic words that aren't don't find their way into Turkish lexicons of the period, but are actually words that are unique to the Syrian dialect of Arabic. So he encounters pears, and he calls them an injas, and he spells this with a seen instead of a swad, and tells us this is the word for this wonderful fruit that I've been enjoying here in Istanbul. And that word, according to the lexicographers and Arabic experts, is a word that is a unique sort of Syrian dialect word for a pear. And that tells you that the people that are talking to him about the things that he's experiencing are largely Arabic speakers, and they're largely Arabic speakers coming from this circle of friends who are living in Damascus. So those are the two anecdotes that come to mind, the humorous anecdote and the anecdote about Shibli's book, which I think, again, both opens up this, opens a window onto the transmission of knowledge across region in multiple directions, but it also sort of opens a door to exploring this sort of multi-layered aspect of the travelogue. I think I answered your question.
Thank you so much for that treat. I hope it incentivizes some of our listeners to pick up a copy, because it is truly a wondrous travelogue, and the translation that you've done is an enormous service, really not just to South Asianists or Middle Easternists, but I think literary culture at large. I guess as a final question, I'm sure many of us, including myself, would love to know what you're currently working on and what we can look forward to reading from you in the near or distant future.
Oh, goodness. Well, let's see. My main book project is, of course, the intellectual biography of Shibley. That was what my dissertation work began. And as I mentioned, this book sort of grew out of that dissertation and in many ways is a project that I envision as being sort of complementary to the monograph, which looks at, you know, Shibley's life and the relationship between experiences like his experiences traveling in the Ottoman Empire and Egypt in 1892, and his life as a theologian, as a literary critic, as a historian, as an educator, a professor, institution builder. So that's sort of my main project. But I'm working on a few other things. You know, I edit the Journal of Urdu Studies for Brill. I'm a co-editor of the, very clear, I'm a co-editor of the Journal of Urdu Studies. And that takes up a great deal of time, but has also been very rewarding. Because, of course, you know, this travelogue was written mainly in Urdu. And so it is, I hope, a work that scholars of Urdu studies are going to find meaningful and helpful and engaging. I suppose mention as an aside that the travelogue was written in four languages. There's Arabic, there's Persian. I had to learn a little bit of Ottoman Turkish to translate it. So it's a multilingual text, just as Shibley was a multilingual thinker, writer, and scholar. So part of my challenge as a student of his works and his ideas is to understand this world in which he writes and the texts and ideas that he's thinking through as a historian, as a critic, as a theologian, etc. And so I have a couple of projects that I'm working on related to Arabic rationalism and Persian wisdom literature. Hopefully those will be coming out soon enough. I don't want to say too much about them, but hopefully those will make an appearance alongside the biography.
Thank you so much for that. That sounds really exciting. And I just want to say that I'd like to have dibs on inviting you once again to the podcast when, you know, that comes out.
I'd love to come back. This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bruce, for joining us today. And thank you to our listeners as well. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. And please do get your hands on this translation. Once again, it is called Turkey, Egypt, and Syria, a Travelogue by Shibley Nomani, translated by Gregory Maxwell Bruce and published by the Syracuse University Press. Thank you once again, and see you next time.